Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Military History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Porter Blackburn, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Steve Vogel about his new book, Betrayal in Berlin, the true story of the Cold War's most audacious espionage operation. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And I wanted to say right out of the box, this book, Betrayal in Berlin, is fantastic. I read it from cover to cover. Just a great story, interesting, informative, exciting, a lot of plot twists, the characters, the personalities, everything. It was just a highly enjoyable book.
Great. Well, thank you for saying so.
Yeah. Yeah. Just really, really nice. So I want to be careful. I don't give away too many of the interesting bits of information about this book, but there are so many. So I just wanted to start at the top, just at a high level for our listeners. This book is about a tunnel, but it's a very special tunnel that was built in Berlin, Germany in the 1950s by American and British intelligence to tap into phone lines used by the Soviet Union. And I want to get into the body of this book with you, Steve. But before we do, I want to really quickly go through your bio and then we'll get into the book itself. So, for our listeners, Steve is a veteran journalist who reported for the Washington Post for more than two decades. He covered the fall of the Berlin Wall and the first Gulf War, as well as military operations in Somalia, Rwanda, the Balkans, and Iraq. His coverage of the war in Afghanistan was part of a package of Washington Post stories selected as a finalist for the 2002 Pulitzer Prize. He also covered the 9/11 attack on the Pentagon. Steve is also the author of Through the Perilous Fight, 6 Weeks That Saved the Nation, and The Pentagon, A History. Now, on top of all that, Steve was born in Cold War Berlin. Additionally, Steve's father was stationed in Berlin, working for the CIA from 1957 to 1962. So this is an amazing background for Steve. So I'd like to start off with my first question, Steve. Could you tell us what inspired you to write this book?
Well, it was some of those ties you just mentioned. You know, having been born there a little bit after the the tunnel operation took place, but before the wall was built. So I was there when the wall went up, in fact. And my dad used to joke later that that was no coincidence. They put it up to keep me out. But I went back as a student. I studied German in high school and in college, and I went back on a bike trip through Europe and went through Checkpoint Charlie in the late 70s, and then fortunately ended up back in Germany as a journalist, working as a reporter, writing for the Army Times, as well as stringing for some other papers, and happened to arrive in Germany in 1989, just a couple of months before the fall of the Berlin Wall. So I ended up covering that. And initially, I'd only planned on being in Germany for a few months, but I ended up staying there for 5 years and, covered the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Warsaw Pact, and all the amazing events that accompanied that. And just based on that, my father had died quite a while ago, but been in touch with many of his closest friends, and sometimes would hear some of the stories of the old days in Cold War Berlin. And I just had always felt drawn to that era, and ended up picking this story about the tunnel as being, you know, one of the, I think, most amazing, less known Cold War stories.
Yeah. Yeah. And what an amazing story it is. And I have to say, when I was reading the book, I had to keep stopping and thinking to myself, this is a real story. This is not fiction. This is not a spy thriller that somebody kind of cooked up on their own. It's all true. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
I kept thinking of that.
A lot of that stuff you just can't make up. It's sometimes better.
I know.
to just let the truth tell itself, because a story like this especially.
Yeah. And I just love the way all the pieces, so to speak, fit together. As you read through the book, you introduce a lot of, to me, fascinating people. And there, in fact, to me, there's just so many interesting characters in the book. Maybe we don't have enough time to go through all of them, but I want to call out a couple of them, if you don't mind talking about them during this interview. And the first one that comes to mind is a central figure in the book, who is a gentleman named George Blake, who was a mole for the Soviet Union. And could you talk to us a little bit about that particular person?
Yeah, I mean, even when this book picks up the narrative, he'd already led quite a storybook life. You know, his father had been come from Turkey and had fought for the British during World War I. He'd become a British citizen and had gone to Holland at the end of World War I with the British Army and married a Dutch woman, and their first child was they named George after King George. And George Blake, his father died when he was quite young, and the family was in pretty much bankrupt. And George was sent to live with wealthy relatives in Egypt who saw to his schooling. And he comes back to Holland just in time for the outbreak of World War II, and ends up missing the evacuation with his mother to go to England, and instead lives as a, you know, basically a 14-year-old schoolboy, becomes more or less a courier for the Dutch resistance, and living underground for the next year, undertaking all kinds of pretty dangerous missions, delivering messages and so forth. And he begins to fear that he's going to be arrested by the Nazis, and makes his escape through Europe, and ends up arriving in England and, you know, serving in the Royal Navy. And because of his skills as a underground and language skills that he had, he's recruited by British intelligence. And by the time that our story begins, he's been sent to Korea as the head of the SIS, British Secret Intelligence Service, station in Korea. And he, once again, he's arrived just in time for the outbreak of a war. He's always in these incredible situations, and he's taken prisoner by the North Koreans undergoes all kinds of horrendous treatment, along with a number of American GIs who he was held prisoner with. But without going into too much of the story, he comes back to England when he's released, given a hero's welcome back in England, and he's assigned to a very sensitive role in British intelligence. But unbeknownst to anyone, he has made the decision to turn sides and work for the KGB.
Yeah. And you kind of touch on something that I kept thinking as I read the book, which I enjoyed so much, is that there are so many parts of this book where the reader thinks, okay, so I think I know where we've progressed to. And then the book goes in a different direction, or a person makes a different decision or something. And I thought George Blake was such an interesting character that he seems so agile. Just he's just dealing with life situations over and over again for just years and years on end.
Yeah, to this day.
Yeah, so I thought he was extremely interesting. And of course, the other person, if you don't mind just chatting with us a little bit about, was Mr. Bill Harvey, who was with the CIA. And he's characterized as the brains behind the American and British effort to build the tunnel. But I thought he was so colorful and so interesting. And I love the way you described him in the book. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about Bill Harvey?
Yeah, I mean, he's one of these guys that you would think was drawn from a spy fiction novel, but he's not at all your typical or sort of the perceived typical CIA officer of the 1950s. You know, one of these Eastern establishment Ivy League type characters. Instead, this is he's basically a guy from Indiana, a G-man. He'd worked for the FBI, heavy drinker, you know, big bulky guy, and quite uncouth in many ways, but at the same time, very smart. And for the FBI, he becomes one of their top Nazi hunters during the war, a guy who is able to break up some of the Nazi spy rings operating in the United States during World War II. And then at the end of the war, he is turned on to Soviet infiltration into the United States. And he becomes really the leader of the first efforts to counter Soviet espionage in the United States after World War II. And he ends up falling afoul of J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, because of, you know, his tendency to thumb his nose at authority, and his heavy drinking leads him to, you know, fall asleep in his car in the middle of Rock Creek Park in D.C. And he ends up quitting the FBI and the CIA, which was the new intelligence operation. Was only too happy to hire him because they desperately needed someone with his expertise about Soviet intelligence, and he found a new home there.
Yeah, I found that character so fascinating throughout the whole book, and like you're saying, he was very effective at his job at the same time, but he kind of didn't fit the mold that maybe people would have of a person achieving those types of goals.
Yeah, he had a real nose for a spy. He was just, I mean, he's the guy who ends up really fingering Kim Philby as a spy for the Soviets, you know, when other people, including the famous James Angleton, were more or less lulled into thinking that Philby was completely trustworthy. It's Harvey who begins to suspect that. And so he's extremely effective for the CIA.
Yeah. I want to touch on just the city of Berlin, the locale of where this tunnel ultimately gets built, because we are in the 1950s, and you touch on it. You have a couple of passages in your book that touches on this, but I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about it in this interview. Is that what was Berlin like in the 1950s? Why was it so special?
Yeah, it was a pretty unique place in the world at that point. I mean, it was really the epicenter of Cold War espionage, and that a lot of that is by virtue of geography. Of course, Berlin is situated in the eastern side of the Iron Curtain. It's in the borders of East Germany, yet it's a city that's occupied by the four Allied powers of World War II. So you have United States, Great Britain, and France on the western side of Berlin, each operating their own sector. Then you have the Soviet sector on the east side. And this is really the one window that the Western Allies have behind the Iron Curtain, because we'd had very little success operating any kind of espionage operations behind the Iron Curtain. Stalin was rolling up any attempts we made to put agents into the Soviet Union. So we were getting very little information about this huge Red Army presence that maintained a large footprint in Eastern Europe, including, of course, in East Germany. And so Berlin is kind of our window behind the Iron Curtain. And it's also a place where you have this free flow. This is, of course, before the wall is built. So even though it's a divided city, there's free transit across the borders, the sector borders. So 10,000 people or more every day are going back and forth, you know, to jobs, to visit relatives, to buy, you know, go to the stores. And a good number of these people are involved in espionage of some sort or another. So you have, you know, the U.S. is recruiting people from the East to bring information over to the West, and of course, vice versa. So it was described as one CIA officer there at the time as this cross between Casablanca and Dodge City, because it's a lot of kidnappings going on and all kinds of stuff. So it's also the epicenter, the center of communications for Eastern Europe. You know, all the communication lines come into Berlin like the hub of a wheel. So you have all these spokes coming in, connecting to, you know, Bucharest, Moscow, and then other points east, and then onto the west. So this makes Berlin a vital place for both the East and West during the Cold War.
Yeah, and I thought it was fascinating the way you explain that in the book. And again, I want to mention the name of the book for our listeners. It's Betrayal in Berlin: The True Story of the Cold War's Most Audacious Espionage Operation, written by Steve Vogel, who we are honored to have with us on our podcast for an interview today. I just thought that was so interesting the way you explained to the readers, folks, this is what Berlin was like in the 1950s. And then the book gets to the point where it starts talking about the decision to dig the tunnel and all the various people involved with this decision. And it seems like it got approval at very, very high levels within the U.S. Is that correct?
That's right. The U.S., of course, is desperate for good information. Eisenhower had been sworn in as president, and he was very frustrated at the lack of almost any intelligence he was getting about the Soviets. And he was quite fearful that particularly now that the Soviets had exploded their own nuclear weapons, they'd managed to spy ring get a hold of some of the Manhattan Project secrets. They'd explode their own nuclear weapon in 1949, then a hydrogen bomb in 1953. And Eisenhower was desperate for good intelligence, and so was Winston Churchill in Great Britain. Churchill had come back to power, so Eisenhower and Churchill, these comrades from World War II, are pushing their intelligence agencies to get better intelligence. Eisenhower is actually quite fearful that he might be put in a position where he has to launch his own preemptive strike against the Soviets out of fear that they're going to launch one against him. So he's seeing this as a possible nuclear Pearl Harbor, and it didn't take much to convince Alan Dulles, who was the head of the CIA, to go forward with this expensive and risky project, and it gets the okay from Eisenhower and Churchill as well.
Yeah. And then there are some passages in the book that talk about the decision-making process as to where they're going to begin digging the tunnel, which I'm not going to get into that too much right now. Suffice it to say, it's as interesting as so many sections of this book, just the whole thought process, and in addition to just the decision to do it and all the levels of government that were aware of it and felt it was an urgent and important project. And then it just was amazing that George Blake tells the Soviets about the tunnel and they end up doing nothing.
Right. Yeah. One thing to keep in mind is, even though this gets the approval at the highest levels of both the U.S. and Great Britain, the number of people who know about it is, you're talking about a handful, literally, in each country. So it's Bill Harvey who's running the operation, who was sent to Berlin to oversee this tunnel. You know, he's got a base there in Berlin, and even his deputy doesn't know about the tunnel. He's doing this in secret from his own staff, essentially. He's only got one or two people that he brings in to the operation. Even though they also have to bring in the Army Corps of Engineers to dig the tunnel. But again, this is something that's very close hold. And you have one team of engineers that are put on this assignment. They don't even know where they're going to be. They're told is they're going to have to dig a tunnel in secret somewhere. And they practice out in New Mexico and, you know, assemble all this equipment that's has to be sent to Germany. And and George Blake, as you mentioned, becomes aware of this project almost from the start, because he's overseeing, helping oversee some of these communication intelligence operations. But he is one of perhaps three or four people in British intelligence who know about it. So he's in a very vulnerable position. So even though he meets on this double-decker bus in London in early 1954 as this project is hasn't even, the first spadeful of soil hasn't even been dug at this point, but he's reporting to his KGB handler about this. But in the KGB, and when we say the KGB again, we're talking about a couple of people. Ivan Serov, the head of the KGB, is informed about this, and he makes the decision that they're not going to tell anybody about this, including the KGB chief in Berlin is kept in the dark, at least initially, and the Red Army, whose lines are vulnerable, they're the commander of all Soviet forces in Germany is kept in the dark. So the Soviets are very interested in protecting George Blake as this mole. And if they do anything to block the tunnel, Blake is going to be blown sky high.
Yeah. You're reminding me of another aspect of the book that I think is so enjoyable is you have passages where you describe George Blake interacting with somebody from the Soviet Union and how they communicate and how they signal to each other, things of that nature. And it's just really interesting. And there's so many sections in the book where it's okay, now George Blake is going to be meeting with so-and-so, and you talk about how he exchanges information, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I was fortunate, in that some of the people who were involved in this story are still alive, or at least, they were still alive, when I was doing the research, both on the American side, the British Secret Intelligence Service, also George Blake is still alive, 97 years old, and I was able to interview him and get details about how the whole operation works. So a lot of research in both in Germany and the Stasi archives and in London and in the United States as well. So I was able to piece together the story of how it worked.
Just approximately how much time would you estimate you spent researching this book?
I started in 2014. Immediately my first focus was doing interviews because so many of the people involved in this project were at least in their 80s, some in their 90s. One was 100 years old, and that really continued throughout the years I was working on it. But then the archival research. So really, the prime research time frame was about 2 years. But even after I started writing, I continued doing research, even though, you know, you're trying to buckle down and write the story, but, you know, I'd get new leads, you know, I'd find a new person to speak to or hear, you know, learn about some archive somewhere that might have relevant records. So, The research continued really almost till its publication 6 or 7 months ago.
Yeah, and again, the book is entitled Betrayal in Berlin, The True Story of the Cold War's Most Audacious Espionage Operation by Steve Vogel that we're interviewing right now. I'm really encouraging people, get your hands on a copy of this book and read it. I think you will really enjoy it and find it interesting and entertaining. And it comes across so much that you did phenomenal research and you actually spoke with George Blake. Is that correct?
That's true. Yeah. It was, as soon as I decided to do this and, you know, knowing that George Blake was still alive, I knew that I had to try to, interview him. I thought it was kind of a long shot. Just finding him to get in contact with him in Russia was not easy, but, and you know, I more or less my first conversation with him, I just called him out of the blue. It took a while to, you know, trying different sources to find a phone number for him. I didn't want to go through the, you know, Russian intelligence services because, you know, basically if you make these requests, they just say no. So I thought, well, the best thing to do was just kind of to call him out of the blue and just, you know, introduce myself and told him I was working on this book about the tunnel. And, he was receptive, ended up talking to him, a second time more in depth. So, that was fortunate for sure.
Yeah. I wanted to move on to a section of the book, and again, just very interesting, entertaining passages about the actual digging of the tunnel. And you've touched on it already, just the staffing of it and the fact that you'd have people who really, they didn't know other people or they didn't really know what was going on, but they were involved with something. And just all the thought that went into digging the tunnel, how to making it a success, essentially. And I remember one passage. And correct me if I'm remembering this wrong. Didn't the Americans and British actually decide to build a phony radar site or something to cover up where they begun digging the tunnel?
Yeah, I mean that was one of several covers that were used, and it was almost, you know, kind of a impromptu thing that led to the radar station. The first thing they had to come up with was. Because they were digging this tunnel from, you know, it was a quarter mile long tunnel, and they are doing it from a point, right on the American Soviet sector border, where kind of a more rural part of Berlin, where anything they do is quite visible to the Soviets and East German guards who were along the border there. And if they start, you know, digging a tunnel and carting away soil, that's going to be quite obvious to you know, anyone. So they decide to build a warehouse, an army warehouse on this site, and use the warehouse instead of like trucking off the fill. They just store all the dirt, the soil in the warehouse itself. And, that was the first kind of cover for this project, that it was just some weird army warehouse. But then they just, you know, they decided, well, they're going to be kind of suspicious about all this activity at this warehouse. We should give some sort of reason for all this activity. And they came up with the idea of putting radar dishes on the top, because they were pretty close to a Soviet airfield there. And it was a logical place to have a radar intercept station. And in fact, interviewed the CIA's communications site director who was overseeing that part of the operation. And he just decided that, you know, heck, let's make it a real radar. The best way to make mm-hmm. it look real was to make it a real one. So they brought in Army Signal Corps soldiers who don't know about the tunnel. They're in a separate, you know, even though this is a small installation, they're kept out of the bowels of the warehouse, and they're only allowed up on sort of the second floor in the roof where the radar dishes are. So the electronic intercept operation is kept quite separate from the tunnel operation. So it's very compartmentalized.
Yeah, very enjoyable section of the book, reading those passages. And again, I know I've already said this, but when a person reads this book, every once in a while they have to stop and say to themselves, this is a real story. This all actually happened, which makes it all the more enjoyable. Phony radar site.
Because a lot of it's comical too, because, you know, sometimes you end up with these Keystone Cop type situations, and, you know, there's the time that, they've got air conditioning in the tunnel, but they fail to recognize that all the heat from the equipment that they have to operate the amplifiers and so forth is going to generate heat along the entire line of the tunnel. And, you know, when it snows, you then have like the snow's not sticking on top of the tunnel. It's pointing like a neon light arrow pointing like there's a tunnel here. and people are just running around like chickens with their heads cut off when they notice that. But fortunately the snow continues and it gets covered up.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that's just one of so many classic parts of this book, and that's why I liked it so much. So now you remind me of another topic I wanted to ask you about, which was just the equipment that they use. There's some fascinating passages in this book where you talk about, well, they're going to use this equipment and they're going to need, you know, X amount of this and X amount of that. And then it turns out when they successfully tap the lines, everybody's saying, wow, this is a goldmine of intelligence that the Americans and British are getting on the Soviets. But there's one device that you described that, if you don't mind describing it again in this interview, it's something called Bumblebee. Is that what it was called?
Yeah. Yeah. The Bumble, that was a demodulator basically, because, what happens is, just to give, more background for your listeners. I mean, the amount of communications they're intercepting, I mean, these aren't a few phone lines, you know, belonging to the general or his aides or whatever. These are three trunk lines, which are carrying all the communications, essentially, of the Red Army in Germany, which is, you know, an enormous force of close to 400,000 forces in Germany and Poland and Eastern Europe there. You know, all these installations are linked in. So they are intercepting 1,000+ communications per day, which a lot of them are telephone, but a lot of them are also teletype communications, which are being sent, on these cables, and some of them are coded and all that. And all of this is being recorded. Some of it is being listened to live by a team of translators there in Berlin. But they have 150 recorders inside this operations room in the warehouse, just spinning all the time, these huge tapes being made on these Ampex recorders. And these tapes are being flown almost on a daily basis The teletype is being flown to Washington, D.C., and the voice communications are being flown to London, and they have teams of, you know, several hundred at both in London and Washington of translators, transcribers, analysts going over this information. They don't really know where it's from exactly. They don't know it's a tunnel. But for the teletype communications, these are being processed at this, you know, old temporary leftover World War II building on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., quite close to the Lincoln Memorial. And it's just a decrepit old building that used to be there. And to take apart the teletype, the teletype tape is being brought in, and each one of these tapes has, you know, sometimes six or a dozen different teletype communications on it, and they have to be demodulated. So they had this amazing device that the CIA communications staff had put together that they nicknamed the Bumblebee, because, you know, you just couldn't believe it was going to fly. Basically, it was this large device that broke apart the communications so that they could be put onto individual tapes and then transcribed by the team there. So it was, you know, a highly secret machine, and only the operators were allowed in that room. So, you know, all the various people that are working transcribing the information would, you know, if they wanted anything, they would have to knock on the door, and, you know, somebody would just open it a crack and take, you know, take whatever they needed. And, you know, all this stuff is being stored in safes in this decrepit building. And, you know, they have so much stuff there that, you know, it looks like the floors are about to collapse at any moment. So,
yeah. And you can tell I'm a fan of this book, but that topic, which you cover quite a bit in the book, it's just interesting, you know, so creative, so diligent, and so much secrecy, and they're getting all this information. And so just to circle back to this earlier idea, I think it's the case, is that the Soviets have still done nothing. Is that correct?
More or less. So what happens is, you know, they are trying to monitor some of the progress of the tunnel as it's being dug. And, you know, Blake is at this point still in London in the special section Y that's overseeing the tunnel operation. So he's in a great position to report progress. But then, ironically, he's sent to Berlin for a new assignment just as the tunnel is about to become operational, just as they've finished the tunnel. They bring in, you know, the British, it's a joint operation. So the British were the ones with the great telecommunications experience, because they had done a smaller tunnel operation in Vienna, and they brought in these specialists to actually do the taps, which is a very intricate, delicate operation, you know, 27 inches below the surface of a major highway there in East Berlin, where, you know, people, East German patrols are walking overhead. But they get the tap done. But Blake, being in Berlin at this point, is no longer really in a position to monitor the operation. He can't, because he's no longer responsible, he no longer has a need to know. So the station chief in Berlin for the British, Peter Lund, you know, he can't go up to Peter Lund and say, "Hey, you know, how's it going with the tunnel?" Because that would have been a red flag. So the KGB's theory on this whole thing was, well, you know, this is the Red Army's, these are the Red Army's communications primarily. And that's more or less true. But, of course, this also includes the GRU, which is the Soviet military intelligence. The GRU deals with the KGB a lot. So while the KGB's lines are protected, they're on these overhead lines that are not being tapped, these protected, highly prized lines, the GRU communications with KGB in Germany are primarily over these underground lines that are being tapped. So a lot of the KGB's own communications are being intercepted. And it's not clear to me at all that the KGB understood this initially, because the scale of what the West was capturing stunned. First, it stunned the CIA and British intelligence, and the KGB didn't fully understand this initially at first, but they tried to give some very generic cryptic warnings to the Red Army command that, you know, you should be more careful about your telephone security. You know, but they don't say because the CIA and SIS are, you know, dug this tunnel or tapping into your lines. It's more kind of vague. And, you know, in these bureaucracies, those warnings are kind of lost. And so essentially very little was done. And after about 6 months of operation, the KGB realizes that something has to be done to put a stop to this, but they're still afraid of exposing Blake. So they have to come up with a very elaborate scheme to discover, quote unquote, the tunnel in a way that protects Blake. And, you know, they have to wait for the right series of events. You know, the weather, you know, it's a, as you know, kind of a kind of a crazy story as to how that all happens, but they, you know, they need to wait for, excuse to go out and send crews out to look for short circuits in the line. So that doesn't happen until the tunnel has been in operation for close to a year.
Yeah. And the section that you're talking about is another great section of the book, which is very, very interesting. This sort of staged discovery of the tap, so to speak. But another part of the book I thought was so interesting is that the Soviets thought that if they bring this tapping and this tunnel to the attention of the press, it's going to cause a certain reaction that is favorable to the Soviets, but it really didn't turn out that way, did it?
No. And you know, it's a lot of things didn't turn out as they expected, both for the, you know, CIA and the Soviets, because, you know, Bill Harvey and Peter Lund were pretty confident that, you know, once the Soviets find this tunnel, they're going to keep it quiet, you know, because this is going to be huge embarrassment for them. So they weren't too worried about that. They were more concerned about the, you know, physical security. And Bill Harvey, you know, in typical fashion, because he, you know, he loved weaponry of all kind. He had, you know, laid this explosive, C5 explosive through the entire length of the tunnel. And he wanted to blow the tunnel, you know, once the Soviets discovered it, you know, with the Soviets inside. But, you know, he didn't get approval for that. The Soviets instead, the idea is they're trying to pressure the West to get out of Berlin, because, you know, Berlin is a vulnerable spot for them. You know, they've got the Iron Curtain has been pretty effective, but Berlin is, you know, kind of this thorn in the Soviet sides, as Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, considers it. So he, you know, they're trying to put pressure on the West to get out of Berlin, and this tunnel kind of plays into the narrative that the Soviets are trying to promote, that the Americans, you know, they're not here to protect the Berliners. They're using Berlin as a nest of spies, and the tunnel, you know, is made like exhibit A for this story that, well, it's not really a story because it's true, but they want to make it clear to the world that the CIA is involved in this nefarious espionage operation in Berlin, and how dare they violate East German sovereignty. And so right after the tunnel is discovered, they call every reporter in Berlin, you know, on very short notice, and summon them to the Karlshorst, which is the Red Army and KGB headquarters in Berlin. And for this press conference, the Soviets hadn't held a press conference at that point in about 6 years in Berlin for Western reporters, but they're all summoned on short notice. And, you know, the Red Army colonel brings them out to the site of the tunnel at, you know, at night. It's all lit up, and they actually bring the reporters down into the tunnel. And, you know, they are just beating the drum about what an outrage this is. And but as it turns out, in the West, the coverage is quite positive, because up to this point, the CIA really hadn't, you know, in the eyes of Western press, at least, had not accomplished a whole lot of anything. And this was looked like an operation where they'd finally pulled a fast one on the KGB, which was like the invulnerable KGB, as it was considered in those days. So, instead, the stories in the West are, hey, look at that. The Americans aren't so pathetic after all. They've actually pulled off this really cagey operation.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that section of the book, the way, just like you said, and there's a lot of parts of this book where the reader says, okay, so now this is going to happen. But then it doesn't. And it just makes it even more enjoyable to read it. Again, we're talking about the book entitled Betrayal in Berlin, the true story of the Cold War's most audacious espionage operation. We're speaking with the author, Steve Vogel. So, you know, what I wanted to ask you also, you kind of touch on it in the book, is that do you feel that the tunnel operation is regarded as a success through the eyes of the Americans nowadays? Do you think it is?
Well, you know, it's largely been forgotten. You know, it went through a lot of different iterations. So you had that initial phase there where, it's considered a success in the West, in the public eyes. I mean, because the discovery of the tunnel is a huge story in the West. I mean, it was really the largest espionage story of the day until the U-2 shoot down a few years later. So they kind of bask in that. And, you know, the Alan Dulles is elated because this allows him to go to Congress and get less of a hard time and easier to get more funding for the CIA. Things changed dramatically, of course, 5 years later, in 1961, as the book describes, when George Blake is suspected and then exposed and then arrested by the British and put on trial. Now he confesses very quickly in interrogations with the British that he had blown the tunnel from the start, and this is a shock. CIA was, Bill Harvey just exploded, at the news. He was not somebody who took news like that calmly. There was quite a lot of concern at that point. Then, was this disinformation? And the CIA, this news, by the way, that Blake had exposed the tunnel, is not revealed to the public. So, it's not until moving forward in the story when, of course, Blake is given this very lengthy prison sentence, and then another remarkable one of these you can't really believe it type events. He manages to escape from prison in 1966 and make his way eventually to Moscow. And it's not until this interview with Izvestia in 1970 that he reveals, publicly that the tunnel had been betrayed from the start. So at that point, then the tunnel becomes this laughingstock. It's like, the Americans were played the whole time by the KGB. They were completely, and so you have a lot of press reports, different books, covering espionage that pretty much give this flat out description that, the whole thing was a farce and it was a KGB disinformation from the start, blah, blah, blah. And so that kind of became the accepted narrative. And to the extent that the tunnel was remembered, because it kind of faded into memory, it was more or less considered a joke or just, another example of KGB just the KGB's amazing skills and how they completely outdo the CIA. So it's really only with the end of the Cold War that more access to records is given, both on the Russian side. Initially, there was George Blake's handler, Sergei Kondrashov, works on a history of Berlin espionage with one of his CIA counterparts, Dave Murphy, who was also my dad's boss. And, you know, he basically describes how they were afraid to do anything about the tunnel because of the possibility of exposing Blake. And then the interviews I've done with with Blake and with others involved, and also an analysis of the information that was done by the CIA and British intelligence. When you think about it, if the Soviets had tried to put disinformation into that, you're talking about 400,000, you know, over 1,000 communications a day. So if they put disinformation into, say, 5 conversations or 5, it's going to be contradicted by the other 955 conversations that are true. They can't put everybody in on this. You can't have like thousands of soldiers all over East Germany, you know, oh, wink, wink, you know, putting out false information, because that would, you know, completely defeat the purpose of protecting Blake, because it would become very clear quickly that there'd been a leak. So basically the KGB's hands were tied, and this is what all the evidence shows. And so now I think it's clear. I think that the book makes a pretty strong case that the tunnel information was genuine, that there's no evidence at all that anything was that any bad information was put in, and that the tunnel essentially provides the West with an enormous amount of information about the Red Army's capabilities and it's basically its order of battle, but probably the most important thing it provides is the confidence that the Soviets are not planning an attack on the West. And this gives Eisenhower, a great deal of confidence that, you know, he doesn't need to order his own strike. And it really, we also get a lot of information about the Kremlin and Khrushchev, because their communications back with Moscow, and information about the Soviet nuclear program. So they draw quite a bit about it. In fact, it takes another 2 years after the tunnel is discovered to process all the information. And, you know, Richard Helms would later say that the tunnel provided intelligence that was still being used a decade or more later.
Wow. Yeah. Now, in the latter part of the book, and again, this book is just packed with plot twists, and you kind of alluded to this next section, which I found so interesting, is that George Blake is finally identified as a mole, but he was identified by another spy? Is that how it happened?
Yeah, it was a Polish military intelligence officer who approaches the West starting in the late 1950s, and he's telling them basically that, you know, the KGB has a mole inside British intelligence, and he shows them documents that this mole has provided. And George Blake is one of the very few people who would have had access to that information. So the CIA, who gets this information from the Polish military intelligence officer who would eventually defect to the West, British intelligence at first dismisses the idea that Blake could be a spy, because he's so highly regarded, and, you know, it just doesn't seem possible to them. It takes a while, but finally, after more insistent reporting from this Polish source, the British conduct another investigation and, you know, finally begin finding some smoking guns that are really pointing to Blake. And he's assigned to Lebanon at this point, and he's lured back to London, and a trap is sprung, and after 3 days, he basically all of a sudden just says, yes, I did it. He just like confesses. It's kind of a remarkable story how that all happens, the whole interrogation and everything.
Yeah. And it's, and I really like this last section of the book. The fact, so you read here, I am the reader, and I read in the book, okay, wow, George Blake was just sentenced to over 40 years in prison. And again, you think, okay, I think this is, we're seeing some closure here. But as you mentioned a few minutes ago, he actually escapes from prison. And it's just another incredibly interesting twist to the story. And the way you explain it in the book, it's just really exciting. Obviously, it's not great when somebody who's committed a crime escapes, but just the way you explain it in the book, because there are passages in the book where I think, I wonder, is George Blake sort of like a low-key person? Because he seems to do these very adventurous things. And do you feel, because I know you interviewed him, did you feel that he's a low-key person who just happens to like to do very daring things? Or it seems like an interesting contrast of two different personalities.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because he's, in many ways, he's mild-mannered. You know, he's very not excitable, and he kind of exudes a warmness, I guess you could say. A lot of people who met him over the years found him charming. I mean, he's good at just sort of getting people to open up, and but at the same time, kind of keeping himself as sort of a low key presence. And I think at the same time, he had lived so much excitement even by the time he was 14, you know, in Egypt, and, you know, it's with the Dutch resistance, and then his escape across the entire continent of Europe, across the Pyrenees, snow covered Pyrenees, to escape the Nazis. And, you know, even well before all this happens with the tunnel and his arrest and all that, he's led this remarkable, and I think he did truly become kind of, and he says as much, that he became a little bit addicted to that sort of that rush of excitement. And I think that's part of what that led him on the path he took. But it also enables him, once he's at this in prison, he's able to charm his fellow prisoners, who generally, when you have like a traitor, a spy assigned to prison, they could be in great danger, because they could be attacked by other prisoners. That's happened. In this case, Blake manages to make a lot of friends across the political spectrum, from people, you know, far on the left to people far on the right. The one thing they all in common was that they all liked Blake. And, you know, he was teaching, he'd teach prisoners languages. He'd hold a French class or a German class, or he'd help them write letters to their lawyers. He was always kind of the shoulder that they could cry on type of person. And, even the guards liked him. So he's able to eventually recruit some people to help him pull off this escape. It's pretty remarkable. And it was a huge embarrassment and disgrace for, you know, the British Home Office, which oversaw the prisons. It was just an enormous scandal. And, you know, to this day in Great Britain, where George Blake is much better known than he is in the United States, you know, people still absolutely pull out their hair at the idea that Blake managed to escape and is still, you know, out there living in a dacha outside of Moscow.
Yeah. So just one of many, many great sections in this book. I enjoyed that section so much, the way you describe all the things that it took to make the escape actually happen. So, kind of watching this clock out of the corner of my eye. I can't believe that we're almost out of time. I just want to say again, we're talking with Steve Vogel, who is the author of Betrayal in Berlin, the true story of the Cold War's most audacious espionage operation. And I'm encouraging everybody to go out and get a copy of this book. I'm positive you're going to enjoy it. So, Steve, I wanted to ask you, I enjoyed this book so much. Tell us a little bit about what you're working on now. What's coming up from your world?
You know, I'm actually just still kind of recuperating a little bit from putting this together. I'm catching up on some smaller projects. You know, I'm sort of thinking about, you know, doing some more work on other espionage operations, but I really haven't narrowed it down yet. I've sort of jumped around from, I think it's part of being a journalist is that you kind of like, you get interested in a lot of different topics. So, I mean, you know, my last book was about the War of 1812, the capture of Washington by the British. And then another book about, you know, the Pentagon, the construction and during World War II, and then through the 9/11 attack. So, you know, I don't know, I might stay with this general theme, or I might end up doing something completely different. But, you know, I'm starting now to realize I need to come up with something. So I'll keep you posted.
Yeah, well, whatever you do come up with, I'm sure our listeners will enjoy it thoroughly. And I can't believe how fast this time, I'm just looking at this clock again. I can't believe how fast this time passed. So I just want to close by thanking you once again for taking time out to chat with us a little bit about this book, Betrayal in Berlin. It's a fantastic book, and I hope our paths will cross again soon.
Yeah, likewise, Porter. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Great. Okay, well, that's the end of our interview for today, and I think we're going to sign off. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.